Watch wood. My name is Jerry Lynch. I was born in Clare, Kilfenora, County Clare. Family of five, three sisters and two brothers. My mother passed away when I was only 4 years. And we had to survive through some rather rough circumstances. But we had good neighbours, and between one thing and another, we made it. Mm. I went to National School in Giffenora, and my father, he was a carpenter by trade. He built houses and repaired houses, mm-hmm. but he was also a violin player. And my mother was also a concertina player, but she passed away when I was only 4 years of age. But he passed on a lot of music through the years, from once I was 6 or 7 years. Then there was another family, neighbours of ours, Ward, Jim Ward, who was the banjo player. That's him right there with the banjo right there behind you. And he was born just like those two horses here, very close. And his brother Tom, Joe, they also played music. So at that time, our house was a kind of a house where people went in Roggone, which means that they came in and they sat down and they played cards or they played music. Mm-hmm. But in our house, there was a lot of music played in it. And I became interested in music later. And my brother and two sisters. But one of my sisters was raised in Kiffinora after my mother passed away. She was raised with an antibody. Mm. And she was very, very musical. But there's my other sister, the far off, standing over there with the violin. And my brother is the third from in the back there with the next to the bass there. Mm. Wait a minute. Myself, yeah. Kitty Mann, my first cousin, Jim McCormick, my uncle, mm-hmm. Gerald O'Loughlin, Nori, my sister, and Jim Ward. That was the makeup. We were the 10 members that won the 3 in a row.
Yeah.
So, nevertheless, to come up with that, I left school when I was 14 years, and I worked in a farm, and I worked with my father, who was a tradesman. Mm. And I started off playing the mouth organ. But then Jim Ward, who worked down as a stonemason, he worked down in Limerick, and he worked in Innes, but he met this accordion player by the name of Joe Cooley, who you probably have heard of. And 34, about 1949 or 50, he brought Joe Cooley up to Clare, where to his home, mm-hmm. for a party. And I heard Joe Cooley playing an accordion, and I think I decided right there and then that if I could, I would play an accordion anyway. So I did. I got to get bought an accordion. 10 bob a week, 10 shillings a week. That's the way the money, that's the way I paid for it. Mm. 40 pound, which was about, 40 pound would be about $70 at that time. And I started learning it. And it was a key of C sharp D. And Jim Ward's brother. Yeah. Sorry, he played a bit of an accordion, and he had an accordion, but it was not too good. But I had to learn to play a few waltzes and mm-hmm. slow things and get a feel of it on that. But then I started off, and I learned on my own to to go from one thing to another. I had a lot of interest in music, different type of music, country western, Scottish waltzes, Scottish music, polkas and all this kind of stuff. And I obviously had a very sharp ear. Then my father used to harmonise seconds. He was very much into it. And playing waltzes, he didn't believe in 4 or 5 people playing straight music. If you could harmonise, you harmonised. So PJ, Norin and Betty and myself inherited, which you weren't taught that. You either have it or you don't have it. Don't ask me how, but if you can harmonise, you can do it. But it's very hard. I don't think it can be taught. You just end it down to you. So the 4 of us, and the fiddle player, Frank Mahoney, who I didn't name there and that, he's... There was country dances where you had parties in country houses and you played music and somebody sang. And there was very little accompaniment going on that time, but for some reason I had a lot of country western and Scottish waltzes and a lovely accompaniment, and I got interested in it. And I was able to do it a bit. So that led on to 1952. My brother, PJ, Jim Ward, they went to take loan to a flat. And that was 1952. So they came home and they decided, amongst the whole 10 of us, we got together. We were all living around the village and we all went into an old school that was there and practiced and played a bit. That they'd start this Kelly band. So at that time, there was the 10 members that are there. There was also Jim McQueenie, a fiddle player, Tom Hagerty, a fiddle player, Paddy McMahon, Marshall McMahon, a flute player, and his sister Nora. Who else was there? And the 3 Wards. Anyway, there was an awful lot of musicians knocking around, but we decided on starting this Kelly band. And in 1954, we played at house dances and schools, and then we played at Kelly's, 1953. And there was 9, 10 playing for the Kelly. Kelly, you played sets, Siege of Inish, waltzes, and a polka, which was a polka, was a kind of a quick step. They used to dance a kind of a quick step to it, but that's the way it would in a Kelly. And we did that for 53 and up to 54. We went on then and we practiced 2 reels, 2 jigs, 3 marches for the band competition. So Mrs. Canole was a national school teacher in Kiffinora, a grammar school, a national at that. And she was very musical. A lot of the music, that there was a brass band in Kiffinora too. Previous to my father was in the brass band, Jim McQueenie was in it. And Jim Ward was in it. They had a brass band for 8 years, I think. And there was a lot of marches and all that, marches and waltzes. That, I think, a lot of the music that was handed on to us came from the brass band and came from the old timers playing the waltzes and all that. But anyway, we we ended up with quite an awful lot of music between waltzes, polkas, reels, jigs, and hornpipes. We won, we went into the hall, school hall in Kiffinora, before the competition which was up in Cavan. And to that was this year, you know. Yeah. But anyway, we went to Cavan and we played at the competition and we won it. That was a big surprise, I don't mind telling you, because I don't think any of us, we had decided we were going to do our best. If we won it, we won it. And if we didn't, well, we were going to enjoy ourselves.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was, in my opinion, the most enjoyable flyer that I ever went to. Probably because of the first one. But I do know, in Cavan Town, there's a square like what you have down in Innes. Mm. And there was a round circle, and there was a wall about that height. And the night was beautiful. This is the night now after the night of the band competition, when the band competition was played. And there was surely 60, 70 musicians that sat in a circle all around that wall, and they included Paddy O'Brien, the accordion player, Joe Cooley, who I was telling you about, and all the Tulla band who were from East Clare here. They were old men. And Eugene Liddy's band from above, outside Canada, outside Cavan. They came second in the flying cabin. And tell them stuff. But anyway, because of that, I thought the music that night started around 12:30. Very, very still outside, and you could hear a kind of a pin drop when things stopped. But the music went on, it went on to 4 to 5, and it went on to 6:15 in the morning. That's when it finished. And some people wanted to go to church, more people wanted to go to bed in the morning. But anyway, we won it. That day then, we were brought out to this Dr. Galligan, who was the man that presented us with the cup that we got for winning this All-Ireland. And in his house we met a violin player by the name of Sean McGuire, who you probably heard of. He, when it came to violin playing, I don't think I will ever hear anything better. Man, and we spent a couple of hours there, and we came home. But then we got back home, but we had to go back to our working, farming and working and playing for Cayley's. That was 1952. We repeated it in Loughrea, 1953. We won there again, and we 1954 we won in Innes. That was the third one. So we had become pretty well established by that time for playing for Cayley's, which were 90% of them were on Friday, Saturday and Sunday night at that time. You may get one during the week, a holiday week or something was going on. But we became very popular for playing for Cayley's because the music we played, the later dance they stood, and the waltzes, which I didn't know, really recognize till afterwards, because Gus Tierney, with the violin player, himself and my sister Noreen played the waltzes straight, and Frank Mahoney and my brother PJ harmonized, and I played them straight, and people were going around that and they look up to know where was this sound coming from, that they couldn't identify or they weren't so sure what was happening. So the crowd started to get bigger and we played more Kellys, and that went on 54, 55 and 56, up along 57 until 59. Then I immigrated and I went to the States. When I went to the States, I went down to the States on 21st of October 1959. And found it very hard to get work at first when I went out there. Things were not too easy to get a job there at the time. I was there for nearly 3 months before I got a kind of a steady job, except a week here and a week there. But then this dance hall opened up. The Red Mill was the name of it. And it was ran by two fellows, one from Cork, one from Galway. They were one from Kerry. They were first cousins, Sean, Dan,
Dan Kiley
Sean Minehead. They were the two that were running. But that started off, and it was going on for three and four nights a week. And it turned out that I played in that, just the traditional music. There was a jazz band playing there. And every half an hour, or three quarters of an hour, they took a break. And I played for 20 minutes, three of us. Mm-hmm. Piano, accordion, myself, and a drum. That went on for 10 years. And then the dance hall started to fade in. The people wouldn't go, and music started in bars, like the Greenbrier. And in New York, nearly all the Irish-owned pubs had music there on Friday, Saturday and Sunday, and you play there to be recording and a guitar and a drummer, three and four. That's the way they went. But I didn't work out full-time, but I played an awful lot of it anyway, through the years. Joe Madden, who was Johnny Madden's father, him and myself became great friends, and he went into to band leading. He'd get weddings, and if he got two weddings, he'd pass them on to me, and I, the same kind of a thing. We worked kind of hand in hand for 8 or 10 years. But I don't know, we played a lot of music, and I enjoyed it, but it was different altogether, different scene in New York. The dance halls, right, they weren't, but it was a different feeling when you go over there first, but then you got used to it, and you got acclimatized, and that's why I continued on playing as much as I could until I came home here. So that was the, there's a lot of ups and downs in music. You have to be very careful. You had to be very careful that time in New York. It was very easy to get involved in drink. And you had to be very careful to draw the line, because a lot of people got screwed up badly through drink and playing music. And that's about the... We came back here then in 1994, and I retired here. I worked in tunnels also. The day job. I always had a day job. I never would put music as a full-time job, because I saw too much happening to guys that I had played with, and they thought that when they were playing music they were in it big time, but music can collapse like that. And it did collapse for a lot of them. But I worked in tunnels for over 30 years, and then came back here in 1987. No, 77. And went back in 89, because I realized that I needed more time and more social security to have enough money to retire. And luckily enough, I had kept up my union book. I belonged to Local 147 of the American stand hog owner from New York. And I was extremely lucky, I don't know what, something made me keep up, I paid the book up all the time that I was home here. That's when I came home, I didn't, when I did come home, I didn't really intend to go back. But then I realised that I wouldn't have enough to after the 10 years here, I wouldn't have enough to retire. And so I went back and I got back into the tournament again. But had I not paid up my owning book, I had no more hope of going to work in New York that time. Just out, I was gone past the, I was gone too old. But I did, and then I got a. After working there for 6 months, I got seriously sick. On my way home from work, I felt a pain in my stomach, and I went in to a doctor who was taking care of us. On my way home, and I found he told me that when he examined me, that I had an aneurysm. And if I didn't take it, an aneurysm should be the size of my finger, and it's already gone that size down here, of the lower aorta. So in 1990, the 5th of January, I was operated on. And on the 12th of January, I got a stroke. Nurses had me up, making me walk, get me to walk out of the round to get my system in order again. I told them that I was passing out, and they didn't told me that I had to walk, so I passed out and I got a stroke, and I didn't wake up till the following morning. They told me that I had been dead three and a half minutes. So the doctor came in and he says to me, "What religion are you?" I said, "What do you want to know what religion I am?" He says, "You shouldn't be alive." He says, "You're the luckiest man that I know. Normally when you're dead 3.5 minutes, you die, and if you don't die, you have brain damage." But I didn't have it. But anyway, I went through the stroke. My left hand was completely dead. My face was gone down sideways. So that came back quick enough, so I went for physiotherapy. And physiotherapist brought back the power of my hand and brought back. I never did get back to full strength in it. But I went back to work in construction and then I found out, I thought that I was able and fit enough to go back to work, but I found that I didn't have a third of the strength that I had before I got it. And I was lucky enough to have a friend of mine who was one of the high up bosses in the tunnels, that he got me an easy job. And that's what kept me going until 1992. And I came back here in 1984. And that's about the story of my...
Yeah. Can I go back and ask you a few more questions?
Yeah, you would. That's what I can think. You ask me whatever you like.
When you were learning to play growing up, did anyone teach you tunes? Or were you
no, just... no one taught. I was extremely lucky. Well, I was lucky, and I suppose I could pick up a tune by hearing it once, twice, or three times. I could pick it up in my head. And I belonged to a parish choir. We used to have a choir at Christmas and high masses and stuff in the church that where I went to. But this Mrs. Canole, who put us through our paces for the practices for the band competition, she asked me to know, would I go into her house for an hour Tuesday and Thursday, and she teached me to read and write music. So I didn't do it. I did a couple of times, but I found it very, nothing happening. And after two times, I didn't do it. But I will tell you this much, I regretted it afterwards. Because when that time when you pick up something, and picked it up perfect, you know, not the whole thing, none of it left out. But then I went out to the States, and I played for quite a few weddings. And when you play for a wedding in the United States, the first dance at your is the Pride and Groom's choice. Mm. It can be a waltz, a foxtrot, or a quickstep, or whatever it is, but it's the bride and groom. Well, maybe 50 or 60% of the time you'd know what had been requested. But if we didn't, somebody had to get it and buy the piece of music, learn it, which put it. I had a saxophone player by the name of Jerry Cooney, who could read and write music just as fast as you could play it. Mm. But anyway, yeah, I'd pick up the piece, whatever that was requested, and he'd played, read it off the book, and I'd learn it from him, which was a roundabout way for going through things. But I regret it, seriously. Mm. Then Tara came home here in 1977, and she went down to Gus Tierney, who was the violin player on the right there. Mm-hmm. He taught 90% of the musicians around here playing music. He taught them for 15, 20 years. He only died a couple of years ago. And I asked him to know what he should teach my Tara how to play music. He says, I will. He said, if you keep away from me. I said, what do you mean? He says, just leave it alone, let her learn, do what I want her to do, and if there's changes, we can do it, but just keep away from her. Just don't. So I did. And to give me due, he taught her every button that was in the recording, he taught her the musical part of it. Mm. And she had learned that off before she played any only a few words in the car, and she had the whole thing off from top to bottom. Christ Almighty. She started in, and she was very quick to pick it up too, but she went ahead from there, and I realised, but for some reason, whatever is going through, even going to school, I wasn't too slow at school, but I wasn't too quick either. But if I was forced into learning something, the harder I'd try to learn, the surer I'd be that I wouldn't do it. If I, for some reason, but I know that it's a kind of an illness that you get, and it can be taken care of now very, very simply. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't picked up. Back in the 19, I went to started. I finished school in 1948, and I started in 1937. Mm-hmm. So. That was no use talking about that, but that's why if somebody put pressure on me, and then the piece of music, when it came to music, if I heard it twice, three times, I had it to harmonize, I could do, I don't know, the harmony just came I could do, nobody ever thought me anything about it, but my father did play it, I listened to him playing it on a violin. He could harmonize anything that can be harmonized, but it was harmonization by ear, not. Harmony by music is a slightly different thing, though. If I could, it's not played the same, and it's slightly different to listen to. People that Tara know can recognize either one when she hears it. When she hears the harmony, she can know whether it is natural, what they call natural harmony, or written harmony. You know what I mean? So I can't follow up on that. And that's where I am right now.
Did you also learn from records or the radio?
Or 90% of the music that I heard, the traditional music, I learned an awful lot of it at home. Mm-hmm. From the musicians here around with Nora. Mm-hmm. She had a brother, Tommy Agerty, who was a violin player. He was in the States when we won the All-Ireland, but he came back in 1957. And he lived over here, and I played a lot of music with him. But you see, it's like what's happening now. You go to flies, you hear music, you pick it up. There were 10 of us in the band, and 10 of us could pick up 10 different pieces of music, you see. Mm. And did you learn this, or did you hear this? And that's the way it was passed down from the. But I had a lot of interest on country western music. And Scottish music. There was a Scottish program that used to be on here from 20, 20 minutes to 10 until 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning. You could get that Scottish program here from October until April. And for atmospherics, after April, you would hardly pick it up to be on in and out. You wouldn't give. But you had Jimmy Shan, William Starr, Bobby McLeod, and about 9 or 10 more that I cannot think of their names that played every Sunday for 20 minutes. Waltzes, marches, military two-steps, jigs, and polkas. Not very little reels from Scotland. But I picked up an awful lot of waltzes, and I picked up, there was a group here from Dublin that played Gallowdas. They played beautiful waltzes, played very simple, and I learned an awful lot. Anything that I'd like, anything that appealed to me, I could pick it up and play it. Country Western, Quick Steps, Foxtrots, all that kind of stuff. And then when I came home here in Ireland, one thing I didn't... I came home in 1978, and I went back in 89. Well, we had a group here, Tom O'Kilkelly and Robbie Kearse and myself. We called it the Mellow Men. And we played in pubs Friday, Saturday and Sunday. And we played traditional country western and waltzes. That's what we played. And I found out during that 10 years that when you mix music like that, it's the greatest thing that a group ever did, because you'll surely hit something that somebody like. But if you keep playing jigs and reels and marches and that, if you don't, you can miss out. Crowd mightn't accept you the same as they will if you mix it, if you play waltzes and military two-steps and marches. That's the one thing that I am very much against that's happening right now. You can walk into a session of music here right now, and the same thing outside in the States, and you can listen to 3 hours of it, and you listen to reels and jigs, yeah, straight through, maybe a few hornpipes. To me, there's hundreds of waltzes and marches and military two-steps that when they're played, Kifnora Band know, if you have heard their the CDs that they have put out, marches and CD and military two-steps on the last two that they have made. And they're very effective, and they're being sold very effectively. That's the proof of it. They have gone to the United States, and they have gone to Japan, and they have traveled an awful lot. And it's what it carries them more than the a certain amount of the reels and jigs. But when you go too far, they have more of an understanding of a waltz, a military two-step, and a march. Marches, you see, you can play a march anywhere or in any part of the world, and it will be understood. Yeah. But you can't, do the rest of it. So that's the way I think and feel about it.
So when you were playing with the band, there was always a lot of variety.
That was the one thing that we played. Waltzes, Stage of Venice, Quick Steps, Foxtrots. That was one of the trio here, which was a kind of a mixed Cayley jazz, if you want to call it that. But I found out that we were booked here. We were booked here nearly a whole year and a half in advance for Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. You see, that's the proof of it.
Mm.
And you weren't really stressing yourself either, because you don't have to put the pressure into waltzes and that kind of stuff. Sure, you have to play them right, but I was lucky enough to be pretty good at them, and I had a lot of interest in them.
Mm-hmm.
There's William Starr, and there's Finbar de Weijer. He's down in this right now, the poor devil. He's played for the last 40 years in England. He's from Cork originally.
Mm-hmm.
There's a family of them down there. Maybe you have heard of them.
Yeah.
And that man could teach you more about waltzes He was unbeliever. And matter of fact, he, this morning here, he was on here on the radio this morning. And he can do things with waltzes on a three-row accordion. And if you try and do something like it, you'll find out that it isn't too easy. So he's my... He's the man that I followed up. And Seamus Shannon, another man. Mm. Yeah, I have a lot of respect for him too. He played with PJ Murray, a musician from West Clare here. He does all country western stuff. But Seamus Shannon played with him, and he got some infection in his jaw that it left a very ragged looking scar on his face, and he became very self-conscious about it, and he quit performing and travelling altogether. He does backup group music with groups that are, you know, that are making CDs and that, but not on stage, you know. Yeah. What I mean, so that's the
when you were playing with the band, how did you travel around?
On cars all the time. Cars, here, yeah. When we were playing with the band, locally, we travelled on two cars. Mm. Because we came from different parts of... We all lived, when we started, within a radius of 10 miles of Kiffinora. But then things got... But if we were going to Dublin, and if we were going way up, say, 3 or 4 hour drive, we had a minibus. Mm. And we'd meet him in Kilfenora, and 10 of us get into that. And I used to enjoy that too, because you wouldn't feel the time going, you know. sometimes we play music, and sometimes talk and different things, but the crowd was together somehow. We never had arguments, or serious arguments, or this didn't... It was a while... period that a couple of them were drinking kind of heavy, but then we went down to Kinturk one night. Kinturk is a very far down south of Saukar. But we played there, and we went into this pub with a thatched roof on it. You know, the roof was attached. 3 o'clock in the morning, it was nearly half five when we left there. And I'll tell you, when the Kiffinora band didn't break up that night, following Monday evening, we had an argument of open Kiffinora at Mrs. Leland. She was the pianist, and she was the woman that ran the band. My brother PJ started it, but after a year, when we won, the booking started to come in, and there was paperwork involved and travelling and all this kind of stuff. She took it over, and with the help of our husband Tommy Leland. Mm-hmm. But we had a meeting up in our house the following night after this Kinturk in 1955. And we laid the law. some things were laid down very, very, very firm, but that was about the only real disagreement that we had. Mm. When the band didn't break up that night, there was no fear of that. But I was with them then until 1959. I immigrated on the 21st of October 1959.
What made you decide to go?
Well, that was a big question. My father had died, and I had a bit up here, and we got married. She had come home from the States.
And I miss every day of it.
She wasn't too happy here.
No.
And we decided to go to immigrate.
And why did you go to New York?
Because that's where she had been. Her sister was there also.
At that time we had to be claimed out by somebody who had their own home and enough to support us for 1 year.
Somebody had to sign documents.
From here, millionaires. You must have read it in the papers. Mm. Two up over in Cape Cod.
It is.
Millionaires that work for the government. Put that down in it. And got away with it.
You had to be claimed out at that time, and you have to be claimed out right now if you go there too. There's no difference. If you're, But then after 5 years, in the United States, you can become play for a citizenship. Mm-hmm. And if you're accepted, then you make it. That's the way it goes. But you have to be there for 5 years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. At one time, if you served 2 years in the army, it was the same equivalent of 5 years out of the army. But now you do 5 years one way or the other. Mm. The army is not that. If you had to serve in the army and go overseas at that time, in other words, you know, Germany or the involved in the Korean War or something, which was not a great option at that time. So, no.
Did your brothers or sisters leave at all, or did they all stay?
No, my brother never left Ireland. I had three sisters that went to England. Mm. And all her sisters, except one, went to the States. So that's the way the two families got scattered out a bit.
Yeah.
She had four sisters and
Two brothers and
three brothers.
The States.
Three brothers.
Three of them went to the States, actually. Yeah.
So
four of them, Gussie, sorry. Four brothers.
Oh, yeah, of course, it's Stephen, Michael, and Tommy, that's right. Yeah.
And I typed below, right near the Twin Towers. Mm.
You were working in a
yes.
office.
It was lovely, but not lovely now. Big space.
Mm-hmm. I'll also tell you this much, that I regretted to the United States at that time with some change. The different environment, the different you were going into, you had to completely change your way of thinking and threaten yourself up, which was good. Yeah.
Did you have a hard time getting used to it?
Well, it took me 3 months to get a job, because things were. But from once I did get a job, I had no problem after that. But if I had enough money to come home during that first 3 months, when I couldn't get a job, I would have come home. Mm. But I didn't. It didn't work out that way. But I'm glad that it didn't, because once I started to move, then things moved. Yeah. But I will say that the music was music was a great backup to me during that the last part of that period of time too. Music is a great sideline at any time, but it's a full-time job. There's, for some reason or another, there was a musicians around New York that time were very rated very lowly altogether. Anything they got was too much as far as the people that were paying them were concerned. You know, it wasn't so that was, but there was someone that did very well there. But it was, then you had long, it started off from 9 to 1, 10 to 2, and 11 until 3. You see, it was the hours were getting later and later. I don't really know why they went that way, but that's the way they went. So, coming home at 3 o'clock in the morning and having to go to work in construction the following day, it was a little bit much, you couldn't do it.
Yeah.
But I did enjoy playing there. I enjoyed, met some very good musicians. Man, I did meet him. I met him in New York, some Larry Redigan, Jack Cohn, Joe Madden, Billy McCominsky, John Nolan, a accordion player, Frankie Gavin. Not Frankie Gavin, he'll know another Frankie Gavin outside. But then you have you heard Brian Conway?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's exceptionally good violin player, that fella. Yeah. Yeah. So There's an awful lot of musicians knocking around now out there, but you would have to be there for a while to know where things were happening, especially now. In the 70s and 80s, you didn't, because it was happening in a pub every night, every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday of the week. There was another place there down, Ireland's 32. It was a kind of a nightclub where all Ireland's 32 was in Third Avenue, and the Jagger House Ballroom was in Lexington Avenue, and there was only a block between them, and an awful lot of Irish people knocking around there. They were dancing there 3-4 nights a week, and it was a lot of bands who were brought out from here to play out there and all this kind of stuff. They were run by Irish people, born here in this country. Yeah. There was four. There was the Jagger House in 86th Street in Lexington. There was the Red Mill in 173rd Street in Jerome Avenue. The Paprin's Ballroom was in 61st Street in Roosevelt Avenue in Queens. And another one, 86th Street between 3rd and Lexington. Tuxedo. They were all going at that time. They were, but then, as I said, dancing all stopped. And they put dancing in pubs, but the dance hall thing stopped.
Yeah.
And it changed the whole lot.
Was it mostly Irish people going to those
90%
dance
Irish.
Yeah.
But you had to... you had quite a mix. Well, I suppose you could say 80%.
Yeah.
Then, especially downtown, you had other nationalities that like here. They come over here. And they like what they hear. Or they meet somebody, and you know, there are lots of different reasons for.
Yeah.
But it would be 80 to 90% Irish that was going in there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And did you play with some of those musicians you mentioned? Did you play mostly out, like in pubs and things?
Yeah, houses.
As well?
I, the dance hall, the Red Mill dance hall, I was there steady for 10 years. Mm. But after that, then the dance hall thing finished.
Yeah.
So it was pubs. And I did play in a lot of pubs in Jackson Heights and Queens, which was nice too, because you were dealing with a lot of different people. And you got to know a lot of different people, and they appreciated what you were doing. You know, you can know, you can feel in the crowd when you're playing if what you're doing is being accepted. You can feel it, and it is a good feeling to feel that what you're doing is kind of right. You know, build up your ego, if you want to call it. But the music is a full-time job. I wouldn't take it. I should lift down the plate anytime, because I saw some, especially in New York, because you could walk into a pub in New York as a performer or as a musician. You could walk in there at 8 o'clock in the morning, and you could sit at a bar, and you could sing a song, or you could play a tune, whatever you were doing. And there was guys that would walk in, guys and women, they could walk in any time during that day. They'd ask you to sing a song. You sang the song. They would automatically one drink, two drinks, put up on the bar beside you. They would, that's the way the things worked. So it turned them into complete wino. So they were there at 8 o'clock in the morning. They were there again at 4 o'clock the following morning. You know, it was a disaster. But after that, when I signed up for that, I decided that, especially some fellas that I had worked with that had good jobs and they played in jazz bands out there, and they became very popular, and they were playing 7 nights a week. It was going on, and then the ballroom thing finished up, and they were like fish out of water. You know, it was burst up homes and things. You would be better off knowing, not knowing at all about it, that for sure. Yeah. No. But I enjoyed New York. I think the United States is the greatest country in the world to work in. And if I was going to work again, I'd go back there. Mm-hmm. That's my opinion of the whole of it. From once I got myself straightened out and working there, things went forward, improving a bit. I did work hard there, part of it, but that's part of life, you see. You have to take what comes and go with it.
What sort of people were you working with? Were there other Irish on the same jobs?
Irish, Italian. A lot of Italians, a lot of coloured. To be more Irish, Italians, and coloured. West Indians. A lot from West India. We've got, especially in the tunnels. But I tell you one thing. And one thing about working in tunnels, the men you work with become your greatest friends, because they can save your life any day of the week under the ground. Mm. You can have arguments over the ground, that's accepted. But if you're working in mining, or especially tunnels, what they call mining in New York, and if you have an argument downstairs, you come up and you're sent up, and you were told this in no uncertain terms where to go and not to come back. Mm-hmm. And for some, the comradeship that I found, I belong to Local 147 in New York. And the comradeship I found there in anything up to 1,400 men, mm-hmm, was unbelievable to the world. You had to be there. Oh, they were friends all the way through. If it went very deep, of course, there were some serious accidents in tunnels too, and people got killed, and not an awful lot of it, but their families were helped out by local 147 members and all this kind of stuff. They were very, when the chips were down, they were there to back them up whatever way they could. That's the one thing that I never did see. I worked in outside construction in New York, and it wasn't, the comradeship wasn't there at all, because the black and white, there was no difference in the world. I went to black parties, I was invited to weddings, it was something that doesn't happen in a lot of other circumstances, even not that I know of. Mm. And yes, I was proud of it. Yeah. It was a great experience, and knocked off the rough edges when you even to talk, to sit down at lunch rather than have an awful lot of the guys from the down south that were born in farms and did some pick cotton and all this kind of stuff, and to hear their life stories and how they came up. They didn't come up in any Sunday schools anyway. They had it rough enough coming up there. Yeah. It's rough as we ever had it here in Ireland, which is something that you wouldn't imagine. If I hadn't gone to the States, I would never have thought it, because it sounds like the money outside the States, nothing to do but to pick it up. You know, you get that attitude here, but it doesn't happen. You get an education working with these type of people to make you think straight. Anyone will lie that there was two sides to every country. But thanks be to God, things worked out pretty good. Yeah.
When you say you were working in tunnels, was that like subway tunnels or roads?
Yeah, tunnels meant subway tunnels, water tunnels. Tunnels, I worked in tunnels upstate New York under a mountain to tie two lakes on together. To establish a bigger water supply for New York City. Mm. When that was done, I worked in a tunnel from Van Cortlandt Park right to Sheepshead Bay in Brooklyn and to the other side of New York to supply a whole new water supply for New York City. That started in 1970, and it's only now it's finishing up. because of different things. When the money runs out, we stop, but there's no finishing up. So they have a whole complete new water system for New York City, and they're on the procedure within the next, I don't know, the 5 or 10 years of closing down the old system and repairing it and opening the new ones. That way they'll have two existing water supplies, which is really working the head, let me tell you. Notice, oh Christ almighty, but they say the United States has, as far as New York, as the city is working, as it's concerned, impossibility doesn't come into their head at all. It comes in, but it's worked around and got out. Some of the things that can get around. I'll tell you something. I lived in the Bronx when I arrived in the States, right beside the George Washington Bridge, where it ties up New York and New Jersey. It was 100 years, when I went out there, I went in 59, I think it was, the Washington Bridge was 100 years old, in something around 62 or 63. And when they built it, it was 100 years before that, they were able to foresee that another level might be required in it. And on the two piers, the both sides of the river, they made reservations where all they had to do was to tie the steel onto what was already built at both sides to put a second. And to me, that was looking, when you look 100 years ahead, you were looking a long way. And it was only about 200 yards from where I was living. I saw it being put together. The Cross Bronx Expressway is what the second part of it is called right now. But to say that they had the vision, and I even saw it on television here, the Brooklyn Bridge, they did something similar with that. You know, they had extreme people out there that were able to promote and get things done and look down the road a hell of a lot farther than what they were able to look here anyway. They're beginning to come around a bit here right now, but they're still 100 years behind it. That's the way it goes. And even strange now, Tara, it's been 2 years in Poland. She just got back. She's only back about a year. They were organising this new factory out there, and she was sent out to be in charge of installing machinery in it. And she was there for 2 years. And Poland is now where Ireland was 50 years ago. And it's just pulling out of it the same as Ireland started to pull out of it. What's going to happen now, I don't know, whether it's going to go back again or not. But it's funny the way things can happen. But as I said, if I had to go to work again in the morning, I would go back to the States and work there. Because it is, you are accepted for what you are, not who you are. One thing you don't do, working in the tunnels anyway in the States, pretend to know you something that you don't know. If you know it, say you know it. If you don't, say you don't and you're willing to learn, and they'll accept that. But by Christ, if you say you know and you don't know and some mistake is made, you're going down the road quick. But that's how you learn things. Hope you don't have to. You wouldn't get fed up listening to me, but that's it.
While you were living there, did you come home much to visit?
I came home. I did. I came home. I went in 59 and I came home in 64. First time I came home. 68. I came home nearly every 3 or 4 years. Mm. Sometimes less. But it never went beyond the 4 years when I came back here. I came home for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, you know, that kind of thing. it was a bit awkward coming home when my son and my daughter were young. Just traveling with kids is something I wouldn't wish on anybody. You have to go through to know. Just like you'll probably, you might find it out yourself. Lots of luck if you do. I know.
As you said you were coming back sort of every few years, and as you were coming back over the years, what did you notice changed the most from when you were growing up?
Well, no, you sure asked a question there, because I will tell you this much. I left here on 59. Well, if you go back to 54, 53 or 54, 1953 or 1954, and come up to 2010, I have seen the greatest transformation in just about every conceivable thing that you can think of here in Ireland. I don't think any other race of people, not race of people, but people that were born here in the 40s up to now, have seen the greatest transformation. I don't think any other 50 years is going to come up with the same transformation in what's that off with education. The standard of education has gone the full length of the alphabet up, because it was up to 1948, 49 and 50, the standard of education here was a lot lower than what it is now. Mm. But then, it's all Faribay around here. And at that time, you had very small farmers, very small farms, with big families, 6 and 7 and 8 people living on them. And they were here, and everything was done by hand. All the tillage, all the hay cutting, all the wood cutting, all the timber cutting was done by hand. And the machinery that has been developed on this past 50, 60 years, there's a lot of the timber going down here right now. Because all North Clare up here has gone, it was all peat, turf. And when that was cut out, the land was practically useless. And they planted trees in it. Trees are left there for 15 years. And there's a chipper factory down in Scariff in East Clare. Beyond Tulla, you've heard of the Tulla Band, it's just the next parish beyond Tulla. And they have another one up in Choom in Galway. And this wood has been, the wood is planted and is let grow. And now it has been cut and made into plywood. All type of board, chipboard, all the board that goes in partitions. You have an awful lot of it outside in Boston, the sheetrock, all that originates, 90% of it from timber, crushed in and mixed with different stuff. But that is, I would say, especially as far as the timber end of it is concerned, that 90% of all the sheetrock and timber has been developed here to a certain extent, and I just found out that it's been exported to Russia. Another thing that has happened right now, Russia has had a very, very, very fine summer. They're exporting wheat and potatoes here from Ireland right now. They don't have enough of them to export, That never happened here. You know, all these things are happening through change and development of machinery. Mm. I suppose automation, development of automation is the best way to explain that. Mm. But automation is the thing that there's two sides to. Automation is great for the industry at a big scale, but it can put an awful lot of people out of work. Mm. I worked, this made me back into something else, I worked in a tunnel outside in the States in 1970 to 76. The tunnel was from Van Cortlandt Park in Woodlawn, New York, down to Highbridge, which was roughly about 15 miles. They made a tunnel from Van Cortlandt to Highbridge. It was 27 foot high and it was 24 foot wide. Now that was the size of the tunnel. And let me tell you something. That's a big, big, big hole in the ground. There was 33 men. There was this drill machine which carried 13 drills. There was 37 men working on that. 3 37ths. 3 shifts a day. That was from 1970 or 1976. I was working on it at that time. Automation was starting to come in. And this mole, which is a new method of tunneling, it has a big machine that goes around like this and is driven by hydraulic pressure. And believe it or not, the bits that do the actual cutting are made below in De Beers, where he was working for the last 20 years. It's a very small world when you get to just the steel. It is a very hard steel that come from Africa, and it won't wear. It can have a lot of. It will last about 5 or 6 times as long as any other steel that they have, and that goes on to the very end of the bit that drills the hole, for them to blast. There was 3 37ths working on that. They finished up out in Sheepshead Bay in the southeastern side of New York with a mole. There's 12 men five engineers, that's 17, and 4 shaftsmen, 21. There's 23 men working on each shift and 37 working when I was in it. And they're getting more work done. And when they drill a hole with this mole, they call it a mole, but it's actually a big round drill that keeps going around. And it eats away through the stone or whatever is in front of it. And it pushes it back onto a conveyor belt. The conveyor belt pushes it up near they put the conveyor, and they put muck cars, what they call, they're like small railroad track and small cars on it. It feeds it into the cars. The cars are tied onto a motor, they're pulled out on a track, it comes up on the elevator, it's dumped into the trucks above, and there's between New York and New Jersey, there's, what the hell was the name of the place? There was thousands of acres of swamp near Newark, New Jersey. That's a note from Newark. All the stuff that has come out of the tunnels in New York and New Jersey was all dumped in here. And they have started, I suppose there's 9,000 houses built on it right now, where they brought it up 10-15 feet to the amazing. And that Our mission is doing all this, you see, it is cutting down the amount of men that's required to do the work. And that you have to be more professionalized. You have to have a trade more. When I went in it, you were taught how to use the drill. You were taught how to use the shovel. You were taught how to drill holes and blast them. But no, the with the mold, there's no blasting, so there's no vibration, and the tunnel comes out nearly as smooth as that. And they just put concrete inside it. And put a ring of steel, and away they go. Not half as much work. That's the changes that's in that end of it anyway.
Yeah. I suppose one other thing that you probably noticed, did you have electricity when did that come in when you were growing up?
2 years.
2 years.
2 years before I went.
Before you.
We had the electricity. You had electricity on the villages. Yeah. Corrifin, Kilfenora, Innes had it, but the rural areas didn't have it.
Yeah.
We had to the miracle that we haven't all blind. We had paraffin oil and paraffin lamp and candles. That was up until about 1953 or 4. Then they went from paraffin oil to a tilly lamp, which was also used paraffin but was pressurised. And it was a tilly lamp now would be about as good as a 75 watt bulb. Mm. And it was oil pressurised. And it had a pen. The oil went in and went through a pipe, and on top of the pipe there was this mantle. You bought this mantle, it was a cloth mantle. You burned it, and when it burned, it came a circle just like a glass there. It was turning the glass upside down and put a hole here and screwed into it. Mm. And then the oil came up in it. And when the flame came to it, it lit. If you touched that flame with anything, the whole mantle collapsed. But they could lash for a, but the light then was as good as any 75, 80 watt bulb. Mm. That was the first advancement from the paraffin. Mm. Then we went from there to the electricity. That was the dim three stages. First off, before the paraffin, they had candles. They used to be the homemade candles. They were able to, the grandmothers were able to make candles with wax and that kind of stuff. So that's I'm not too much into that end of it now, but mm. I don't know about the going from the candles to the paraffin lamp, and from that to the tilly. I lived through that.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't have too much light at night at all, and that for sure. You had no central heating.
Mm.
There was no central heating early at all here until. It would be up in the 60s before a lot of the central heat started to come to the rural areas.
Mm.
You had in towns and different places, but not to the same as what you have now, but it is automatic in every house. There was nothing like it at all.
So when did you have a radio at home?
Battery radio would. A wet battery. They had to be charged.
Mm.
You had to get on a bicycle and cycle. I had to cycle to Kilfenora, to the village. I was born 3 miles outside the village of Kilfenora.
Mm.
I had to cycle 3 miles with that battery. With that battery, with it, it was acid inside. It was dangerous. You had to be very careful with it. It would burn clothes or your skin to do a good job with it too. So you had to be very careful with it.
Mm.
But they went on. You went on then to the. It was all peat, fire, and timber. Peat is turf, you can call it whatever you like. Around here it was mostly turf, but they burn up the burn, but the solid rock is and turf was, there was wood that they used to get after. The burn up here, have you heard, you know something about the burn?
Mm-hmm.
To the mountain in Arclair, there's no water in the summertime, and there's thousands of cattle there in the wintertime.
Mm.
And they have to be taken over there in the summertime because there's no water for them.
Mm.
But up to 25, 30 years ago, nobody hardly knew they were there. All of a sudden some educated people arrived in Ballyvaughan, and they started walking through this rock and mountains of Craig, and they started to find very unusual flowers and different plants that were grown there,
mm.
and things that were not normally, well, they weren't known at all about. And there was dolmens then, mm. where there was people supposed to be buried in them and all this kind of stuff. There. The whole thing was researched, I suppose, is the best way to use it, by the University in Galway.
Mm.
A lot of students and all that came out of that, with lecturers came out,
yeah.
and went through the whole thing. And it's pretty well established now, everything that's happened there. But 30 years ago, it was just a limestone mountain.
Mm.
And nobody, only the people that had cattle there in the wintertime had any clue what was going on there. And the guys that were herders, they walked through it every day. But they didn't realise what they were walking through, you know, the plants. But then the tourists came, and they started to walk through it, and they recognised that there was flowers that hadn't found any other place in the world grow up there. And so it's... But it starts right here above here at this village here, and it goes straight up, which is 17 miles to the Atlantic Ocean, straight up north.
Yeah,
yeah, so that's the way things can change. Man, oh man. At that time, when I left here in 59, you might have visited at least Old Varna, but I say there's the years in between. Once they started coming here, they started Germans and different Germans especially going for identifying a lot of different areas and different countries. They followed through history,
mm.
like what you was simply similar like what you're doing right now, but they go into it very, very deep. And they're not Germans, French, Italians. A lot of them coming over here right now. You see that, and Corinne, I didn't tell you. There's a Corinne, a young girl. I don't know how young she is, but she's a lovely concertina player anyway, and a fiddle player down there in Innes.
Mm.
She's amazing. She's good. I have no objection to this at all, but to make you sit up and realize that some people have offered interest, you know, to start. And come and listen to the music and realize what it is or what they think it is, and then start playing it but they do play with the groups below in Innes, you see, and they give them the crowd in Innes are pretty good too. They let them sit in as long as they don't interfere. If they start to get too loud or to try and they'll tell them to calm it down a bit, but
mm.
other than that, so that's the way it goes.
So I suppose in terms of the music, what's different, what's changed? I know you were talking a bit before about kids now learning to read music.
Oh, wait a minute. You see, that's where you have, I suppose, the greatest transformation of all is there right now.
Mm.
With the music that the kids have and the way that they're being taught to play the music. You see, like you play flute. Well... 90% of the flute players up to 1950, they picked up a flute whatever way they felt comfortable with to their mouth was the way they played it,
yeah.
You know, or held it, or a violin, same thing with your hand, with your some of them hold your wrist in against the violin, the neck of the violin, more of them hold it this out that way because they maintain that you have a lot more freedom with your hand, which makes sense. But if you didn't read music, or if you haven't taught it, you have learned all the things the hard way.
Yeah.
Except somebody, but now, any instrument, I don't care what it is, that you catch up and you've got a teacher to teach you how to play it. They teach you how to hold it, how to get the right sound out of it, and to keep you at it until you do get the right sound. Not some ridiculous kind of a screech, which some of them get. And the technology that they have for teaching, as far as I'm concerned, is out of this world. If you have music in you, if you don't bring it out, it is your own fault, kind of. You know, that's my idea. Because the teaching technology is there. And the easy ways of, like holding a recording, is to get a recording, they'll tell you that it's, oh, just rub your fingers up around the key. Well, that's position that you hold your thumb against the outside of it. Mm-hmm. They can control the whole, you can control the whole keyboard. More, you'll be moving it up and down, do you understand? But if you weren't taught that, you might go through 10, 15 years of your life before you realise it. See, that's the way it is. Yeah. I think it's mighty article. I know that right here above in Corfin, there's Paddy O'Reilly and his brother, come on, Paddy is a piano player. Damien O'Reilly is an accordion player. He plays the guitar. He plays the piano. But he's a good accordion player. He was taught by a fellow by the name of Conor McCarthy, who was a member, an ex-member of the present Gryffindor band. But he's over in Galway right now, but he's a very good accordion player. And Damien, he just after getting a job teaching below in the Christian Brothers School in Innes, he just qualified. And he's in there teaching. And he's teaching music. That was a lot of the reason that he got it. You see, the things are happening now that didn't happen before. And there's Hugh Healy, who's living right next door neighbour of mine here. Mm. Himself, he has two brothers. Hugh is a concertina player. His brother is a fiddle player, and another brother is an accordion player. The concertina player, he's teaching above here in Corrifin. So he's teaching music. It's working around it. There's more musicians being taught here in Corrifin right now in any one year than was taught in 40 years back in the 1950s. See, that's the way it has gone, and they're good ones.
Yeah.
There's no... It's a pleasure to be around it, because sit down with kids of 9, 10, 12 years of age, up, and from there up, especially 10 years up, they're starting to fully developed in my opinion. Hmm. Do you agree with me?
Yeah.
But I'm proud. I'm very proud to see it, though, I'll tell you that. Because there is more Corrifin School, I might as well go into it and follow it. There was a teacher in Corrifin, Nathie Cleary was his name. When Tara came home here in 1975, she went to school up there. That man didn't want anybody to speak any language, only Irish. Mm. Mentioned something about music to him, didn't want to know nothing about it. Games like hurling, football, or any activity like that, he didn't want to know anything about it. He died in about... around the hell, I suppose, around the 60, but anyway, when he died, this fella, Declan Keller, took over as principal teacher. There's six teachers up there now. And you have underage football for boys, girls, plays, what do you call it, doing plays, just about every activity you could think of. And 90% of the kids are involved in it. And the Healy's are teaching music up there, and the Rileys. So you have more kids that can perform one way or another up there right now than you did ever in history. Mm. That's a progress in my opinion. Because if you see that there's a, I don't have to tell you that there's an awful lot of stuff that isn't good going on around. You have dope in every village that you have here in Ireland right now. It's above Inchurrafin, it's in Giffnora, it's everywhere. But if the kids get involved in football and in games and playing with each other and know each other, they have an 80% chance of keeping out of that racket. But if they don't, and they start hanging around corners and sleeping in around pubs and all this kind of stuff, the future isn't too good. Mm. That's the way I see it going right now. So that's why the transformation Corfin Parish has gone through. They built a football pitch and a hurling pitch, which is all one, and then they built two training pitches onto it, and they have a kids park where you bring, you know, with skeets and all this kind of stuff that mothers go in with kids. They built the whole thing within the last 10-15 years. Mm. So that's it's all there for anyone to see right now, and they can be proud of it. It's amazing. I think in this parish of Corfin, not because I'm in it, they have the greatest organising committees that I have seen in parishes in my lifetime. Mm. And they start doing something, and once they start it, you'll see it done in a very short time. But that's, whether that any knowledge is any good to you, but it's part of what's happening around here anyway. But there is more music then, you see, there's 5 times as much music going on there in Corfin. They're mixing from North Clare, and they're coming down to Corfin, and they're involved in Rupert Cures and all this kind of stuff. It's great for the kids because they get a broad knowledge. Yeah. And the kids than people are a little bit more forward. They're not as secretive as they used to be back here. When I came up here in the 30s and 40s, kids didn't have the, what's the word? They acted very shy and like holding on to their mothers. Right now, kids will walk up to you and they say, "Hello, Jerry, or who you are," and you ask them something, they'll look at you straight, and you'll get a straight answer. Whereas you won't get any of this running into a room when they see somebody coming. A lot of that went on here through non-education, especially before the 40s. It was not good. Because the standard of education wasn't good either. Mm. But it's a hell of a lot better now anyway, in my opinion. Don't know.
Is there anything else?
Huh?
Anything else I forgot or didn't mention?
I can't think. No.
Covered quite a lot there.
Well, no, to confirm what I just told you, the greatest transformation that this country has gone through in the last 50, 60 years, I don't think will ever again happen in any 50 years. Because, or if it does, there's something that unexpected is going to happen. Because the production that's gone on and the change of work that's gone up Christ, but I might as well tell you, the in buildings, when I left here in 59, you had to carry building blocks up a ladder onto a scaffold, and the next guy had to carry them up to the next scaffold. Now, you have a machine. You just load them into the front of it and raise it up, regardless of what you have, and leave them up there, and there's a guy above there on the scaffold, you take it off. Not 3 guys having to carry it.
Yeah.
You know, it has simplified everything. There's no more peat now. Peat is tough, you know, that had been burned here for years. Well, they have They have made it, they have turned the peat areas, an awful lot of them, into parks, preserved parks, for bird life. They give them a place to nest and do all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That's something that has come in the last 18 years. It started off with the change of the burn to preserve. But the burn is a national park, right? Now you're restricted in what you can do, what the amount of cattle you can put in there, the amount of timber you have, and they have to organise. There was hundreds of thousands of goats up there. And the people started to come and kill the goats and take them out of there. So no, they have preserved, they have declared it right from Corrifin here, which is only within a half a mile here. It's a national park. And if you have to be, you're not obligated to kill any goats inside that area. So if they do have to kill them, they go by the count. They know when there's too much for them to survive.
Yeah.
And they do the same as they do with the deer outside. They cull them. They do that in the United States too. They cut them down, the number, to maintain the number. Otherwise they become too plentiful and they get diseases and they die themselves. So it is all that has come in now. And it is helping. It is helping. There has more tourists come to North Clare here in the last 20 years than what came in a couple of hundred years before that. But that's the way it goes. Peat had to be cut by hand with this lawn thing, and it had to be spread out in a big area, and it had to be turned by hand, and it had to be put standing up by hand. But that, it was easy to do that then, because you had 7 or 8 or 9 people on every house to do it. But you haven't that now, because immigration, there's only 1 and 2 people in the house that can do that right now.
Yeah.
I'm not the best in the world to explain those things now, but that's the way things have changed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if you have no questions, then you...
I think you've pretty much covered it all.
But I don't know, but I hope that it didn't screw you up when it comes to that you can sort it out.
Yeah.
Because, as I said, you can leave here right now, and I can tell you one thing. I'll bring you down to Innes, but... when you were gone, I'd say, well, Jesus, why didn't I think of this? And why? How come I... But you can do nothing about it, you see. But I will tell you, if there's something you think I can help you with, I will do it.
Thank you very much.